Welcome to Midday, everybody. I'm Sheila Cass. Thanks for tuning in. March seems to be coming in like a lamb, but I gather there is a lion waiting around the corner, so I'm glad you've joined us on this first day of March. Today, we're going to talk about a business structure we don't often think of. We tend to think businesses come in two flavors, privately owned by individuals and publicly owned through the stock market. Today, we're going to talk about a third variety. About 350 businesses in this country are worker-owned cooperatives, according to the U.S. Federation of Worker Cooperatives. That's a tiny fraction of the millions of commercial businesses in the United States, but experts say worker-owned cooperatives are gaining some traction. And those cooperatives may not be what you're picturing. While radical bookstores and food co-ops are among them, the largest worker-owned cooperatives in the United States is a home healthcare business with 2,000 members. There are worker-owned engineering firms and industrial laundries and at least one worker-owned cooperative pharmacy. Can worker-owned cooperatives really compete in the marketplace? Why are they on the rise, and what hurdles do they face? John Duda, Communications Director for the Democracy Collaborative, is here to help answer those questions. The Democracy Collaborative is a policy research institute in Tacoma Park that has helped start several major worker cooperatives. And John is also one of the co-founders of Red Emma's, a worker-owned coffee shop and bookstore in Baltimore. Welcome to the show, John.
Thanks.
Thanks for being here. Joining us by phone is Melissa Young, co-producer of Shift Change, a 2012 documentary film that goes behind the scenes of a number of worker-owned cooperatives in the United States and abroad. Welcome, Melissa.
Good morning. It's morning here on the West Coast.
Yes, yes, it is, and thank you for joining us bright and early. I want to start with a brief clip from Shift Change. In it, a worker owner at an employee-owned engineering and manufacturing company in Wisconsin explains what he loves about his job.
Most other companies, I couldn't share in the decision-making because I wouldn't have a vote. At the end of the day, if the work I did produced profit, I wouldn't get to share in that because it would be going somewhere else.
Melissa, were these the main reasons people gave you for the decision to work at an employee-owned business?
Well, we heard a number of reasons that people really enjoy being a part of a worker cooperative. Some of it is that they really have a say on the job. Some of it is that, in fact, since they decide what to do with profits, and a lot of money is not going off to shareholders or well-paid CEOs, that they actually take home more money. And another thing that they really, really seem to bring up a lot was that these jobs are not going to move away because they, the member owners, decide where the company is and what they do, and they're unlikely to move away from a local community.
So the stability, they see these jobs as very stable.
Mm-hmm.
John, let's back up. Mm-hmm. What is a worker cooperative? I described it, but I'm not sure I hit the most important points.
So a worker cooperative is pretty simple. It's a business like any other business, usually involved in for-profit activities, whether that's selling goods or services. But the crucial thing is that it's owned by its workers, and it's owned by its workers in a democratic fashion. That means everyone has an equal share of the business, and everyone has an equal share in the governance of the business. That means that the big major decisions are made on a one-worker, one-vote basis.
But it's not the only form of worker ownership. I mean, you can have an employee stock ownership mm-hmm. plan that's like a traditional management structure.
Yes. And in fact, there are actually a lot more worker-owned businesses or employee-owned businesses in the U.S. than people realize when they think about the U.S. economy. I've seen numbers that say that somewhere between 10 and 11 million people are involved in employee stock ownership plans. That means there's 10 or 11 million people who own a substantial piece of their workplace in the U.S. Not all of those are run democratically. Some of them are. Some of them are run with remarkable participatory democratic management structures. But for the most part, it functions as a way for workers to have an investment in their company without necessarily having a say in the day-to-day management.
So, Melissa, when John talks about a democratic management structure, tell me what you saw in co-producing Shift Change. What does that look like?
Well, as John says, it's one worker, one vote for major decisions. Depending on the scale of the company and the kind of activity they're involved in, the internal structure and how that's managed may be different. So if it's a small group, it may even be consensus decision-making. Sometimes that's done on a voting basis. Within the company, often there's divisions. For example, Equal Exchange that comes out of Massachusetts and is an importer of fair trade goods. They have a structure where they have two co-directors of the company. They have different divisions depending on one aspect or another of the business, the shipping, the different kinds of distribution, people who are in charge of roasting the coffee, et cetera. So they will have a manager in each of those divisions. But ultimately, the decisions of how the company is run, the major decisions, come right back down to one worker, one vote. So they can actually remove their CEOs if they want to.
But, John, they have CEOs. They have a management structure. Or the consensus model is hard for me to envision working.
Yeah. And I think that's a big myth around worker cooperatives, because people think, oh, my God, we're going to make every single decision with everybody having to agree on every single thing.
Well, at least one of the articles I read about your movement, for example, the headline was No Bosses.
Right.
Is that the right way to think about
it? You know, I don't think it is. I think that certainly no owners besides the workers is a way to think about it. But management is very common, especially in the number of larger worker cooperatives. That management is, as Melissa pointed out, democratically accountable to the workers. It's recallable. It's the same way that we have a democracy in the United States. That doesn't mean that every, you know, one of us gets together and makes every single decision sitting around in a circle. It means we elect people who we think have our interests at heart. And if they don't behave that way, we don't elect them the next time. So there's many worker cooperatives at larger scale that work in that fashion, through layers of representation that actually establish management. And many workers feel that's in their best interests. They maybe don't want to spend all their time in meetings. They want to have effective management that gets the job done and makes the profits that they all share as worker owners. So there's really a spectrum here, and I think it's a lot broader and a lot more interesting than most people think on with their first impression of what a worker cooperative might be.
That is John Duda here on Midday on WIPR. I'm Sheila Cass. John Duda is at the Democracy Collaborative, a nonprofit dedicated to community-based development. We're talking about worker-owned cooperatives. Joining us by phone is Melissa Young, co-producer of Shift Change, a documentary about the rise of worker-owned cooperatives. Can you picture your workplace as a democratic enterprise? If you're a business owner, can you picture the decisions you make being made by majority vote? Join our conversation. Call us at 410-662-8780 or send an email to midday@wypr.org. Melissa, a lot of your documentary focuses on a giant network of worker co-ops in Spain called Mondragon. Tell us a bit about Mondragon.
Well, Mondragon is one of the biggest networks of worker cooperatives in the world, and people like to visit there to get a sense of what could happen if a big sector of the economy were dedicated to worker cooperatives. So in the immediate area around Mondragon, 60% of the people work with worker cooperatives. So it's a huge percentage of the population. And it's a network of 120 cooperatives of different types, industrial cooperatives, educational cooperatives, including a cooperative university, research institutes, a cooperative bank. It's a very developed network. But it, you know, now the first one was founded in the 1950s, and they developed in relation to each other, so with the idea of networking in mind. And what's interesting to me is to, when we talked with people there, clearly having a successful business, you know, producing a product that's in demand and keeping up with the technologies and so forth is really important. But people always said, but for us, at least as important is employment. So jobs is crucial here. And of course, making a sustainable business is necessary for the jobs to be maintained. But it's just interesting to hear that type of priority emphasized. Often, so much is focused on profits here in the United States.
John Duda, Melissa, let me interrupt a second. I want to ask John Duda, is that a characteristic? Is that part of the DNA of worker cooperatives that nobody gets fired?
I don't think it's that nobody gets fired, but I think that it's very unlikely if workers are making decisions that they're going to decide to eliminate their own jobs. So, for instance, I like to think about that example that just recently came up with Carrier, where they closed this plant and you heard these 1,400 workers who were listening to a company representative say, oh, your jobs are being eliminated because it's good for business. Well, okay, it's good for somebody's bottom line. It certainly wasn't good for those workers. And if those workers were actually in charge of the company, if the leadership of the company was accountable in a democratic fashion to those workers, those jobs would not have been offshored. Those jobs would have remained in the community. And I think that's really the key part about worker cooperatives is that it's not just that they have an orientation towards preserving jobs. It's that those jobs are really rooted in the work that people are doing and in their lives as people who are part of their communities.
Okay, but walk me through what happens mm-hmm. in an economic downturn when a business just isn't getting the same orders mm-hmm. that they were getting when they set their staffing a mm-hmm. couple of years earlier. How does a business compete in the marketplace if they can't control costs, if their business goes into a downturn?
I think Mondragon is a great example here. And it's why, for us at the Democracy Collaborative, we're focused on larger ecosystems of worker cooperatives, larger networks, not just individual businesses. Because individual businesses, of course, they fail. If they're in a market, they're competing, they're working on, you know, against things that they don't control, and sometimes they make the wrong decisions. What Mondragon does is they have a network that allows them to absorb those losses. So one of their oldest and largest cooperatives, Fagor, makes appliances, home goods, had a tremendously hard time after the real estate crash when people just stopped building houses in Spain. And what they did was they had to close this company. It wasn't profitable. They couldn't keep it open. They tried as hard as they could. When that didn't work, they closed it down in an orderly fashion, and they made sure that almost every single person who was losing their job at that company found a new job at one of the other cooperatives in the network. So it's that larger ethos that allows you to kind of think about how a democratic economy might work and might build something that's a little more resilient than just a single company trying to make it on its own.
We need to take a quick break here where there's lots more to talk about worker cooperatives, and we already have listeners who want to be part of this conversation. You can also, John Duda, who is with us, he works with the Democracy Collaborative, a nonprofit that supports worker-owned businesses as part of its mission, is also co-founder of Red Emma's, a worker-owned coffee shop and bookstore in Baltimore City. Do you patronize Red Emma's? Does it change your experience as a customer to know that Red Emma's is worker-owned? Call us at 410-662-8780. Send us an email at midday@wypr.org. Documentary producer Melissa Young is staying with us, too. I'm Sheila Cast. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Midday, everybody. I'm Sheila Cast. Today we're talking about worker-owned cooperatives in which decisions are made democratically and every worker has one vote. With us in studio is John Duda, co-founder of Red Emma's, a worker-owned coffee shop and bookstore in Baltimore. He's also communications coordinator for the Democracy Collaborative, a policy research institute that works to transform the economy to a more democratic model. Melissa Young, co-producer of a documentary on worker-owned cooperatives, is with us by phone from Seattle. Melissa, what did you learn in making the film Shift Change that most surprised you?
Well, it was surprising to me that this business model can actually function in so many different kinds of work. So you mentioned the social service cooperative, home care cooperative in New York, which is the largest in the U.S., but we visited engineering firms, bakeries, pharmacies, cab companies. I know there's dog walking worker cooperatives in New York City. They just function in so many different kinds of activity, and they are growing. That's the other part. We're getting more cooperatives. Some of the existing ones are growing larger here in the United States. They've been really helpful, I think, in a number of cases to immigrant workers and younger people who are having trouble finding really decent-paying jobs. They just seem like more of a possibility when we think ahead to having a more democratic and stable economy that really serves the working people of this country. They're more of a viable opportunity than I had imagined.
Did you get the sense that the model is more suited to some types of businesses than others?
Well, there is a difference, of course, in, for example, startup costs for an engineering company, which may need some, or an industrial cooperative, which may need heavy capital. In terms of startup, some of the service cooperatives don't require so much capital, so that in terms of initiating something, that may be simpler. But I think in the long run, for these cooperatives to be really successful, it's the networking among them, such as we're beginning to see in New York City, in Madison, Wisconsin, in Austin, Texas, in the Bay Area, where they provide mutual support for each other, that is really going to make a difference in terms of stability and some steady job opportunities for people.
Vinny is calling us from Baltimore, I think with a comment that picks up on your point about capital, Melissa. Vinny, welcome to Midday.
Hi, how are you?
Just great. How are you?
Thank you. I run a composting company, and my question is very much related to your last comment about industrial and capital-intensive startup companies. We started 4 years ago, and we have a lot of equipment and a lot of startup costs, and I'm interested in worker equity, but how do you juggle that with having to raise private equity from private investors with distributing equity to employees? And given your last comment, do you think it's better as like a transition? And can you give examples or maybe some advice for maybe a company that might want to transition to a worker-owned company after its startup phase?
Vinny, I appreciate the question. Before I throw it to John Duda for an answer, I missed what kind of business.
It's called Chesapeake Compost Works. We're
composting.
A composting company in Baltimore.
Okay, thanks for the question. John, can you address Vinny's questions?
Yeah, and they're really great questions. I think people have gotten really creative about how to get capital to worker cooperatives because it's a big roadblock. We have a marketplace for capital that's designed around certain forms of ownership and not others. One of the things that's been really exciting to see is what Equal Exchange has done. They've raised millions of dollars of capital from outside investors, and they've done it without compromising their democratic values as a cooperative. What they've done
is the exchange in New York?
Equal Exchange is based in Massachusetts. It's about 120 people. They do fair trade coffee roasting. They've been a pioneer for a long time of that kind of business. And what they've done is create two separate classes of stock. One is held by the worker owners and has voting rights. The other is held by outside investors and doesn't have any voting rights but offers dividends. And with that model, they've been able to raise a really significant amount of capital. And that's something that's been picked up on by a number of worker co-ops, both existing and startup efforts. And then on conversion, that's a huge, huge opportunity. There's an estimated 150 to 300,000 businesses that are owned by people who are going to be retiring, looking to sell their businesses every year. And it's a really important place where we can really see a lot of worker-owned companies potentially getting started or potentially being formed out of existing businesses. And that makes things easier.
So you're envisioning situations mm-hmm. where someone owns a company mm-hmm. individually. It's not publicly traded. And they're about to retire, and they're thinking of legacy, and they're thinking that they would rather have this company in the hands of the people who have worked to build it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And
can you give me an example of where that's happened?
So one of the great examples is in Deer Isle, Maine. It's a very, very tiny rural community. and it has a very tiny main street, and the folks who had owned the main businesses, the pharmacy, the general store, for decades, were going to retire. They were like, okay, we're done with Maine. We're done with these businesses. We want to move. I think they were moving to Florida. And what it would have done was devastate this tiny community. It's a community of like 2,500 people. This was 62 jobs, right? So a huge chunk of the local economy was really about to be ripped out and made totally uncertain. Maybe a national chain would have bought them. Maybe it wouldn't be a priority for them. Who knows? What happened, though, is that co-op developers got in touch with these retiring owners and helped them sell their business to their employees. So now those 62 people are in a three-store worker cooperative that is really anchoring the Main Street economy of this small town in Maine. And because of the way we have tax incentives for retiring owners who sell to their employees, these owners were actually able to have a significant benefit, not just the feeling of having done something right, but there's actually a financial incentive for people who do this.
I think if Vinny were still on the line, he would want me to ask, how were those workers able to afford to buy a share of that company? And mm-hmm. what about the ones who might not have had as much in the bank? Mm-hmm. How do you make that kind of financial transaction?
Generally,
Melissa.
Very often in that transition, people make an agreement of putting up a certain amount of capital and then gradually buying in through their salary or their wages.
So you're talking about the retiring owner essentially uh-huh, financing uh-huh. this?
Yes.
Uh-huh.
So actually people often in joining any worker cooperative often put up a certain amount of money and then we'll buy in. In terms of these transition situations, sometimes there's a financial institution involved that actually helps mediate this, but sometimes they're able to make a kind of contract with the existing owner for a gradual buy-in. And there are organizations out there that really assist with this type of transition. There's something called the Ohio Employee Ownership Center at Kent State that has a lot of experience with this. There's various other entities around the country, so I'd encourage people to check that out because you don't have to make it all up yourself.
That is Melissa Young, co-producer of a documentary about worker cooperatives called Shift Change. Here on Midday on WYPR, I'm Sheila Kasten. Here with me in the studio is John Duda of the nonprofit Democracy Collaborative, which supports worker-owned businesses. Can you picture an economy based on worker-owned co-ops, or does this all sound kind of pie in the sky to you? Give us a call, 410-662-8780, or send an email to midday@wypr.org. Don is calling us from Annapolis. Don, welcome to Midday.
Hi, Sheila. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
It seems to me that one of the premises of the show here is that, hello,
we're listening.
Okay. Yeah, sorry. Is that there are profits to share in a democratic worker-owned cooperative. How are workers, what is their appetite for absorbing losses? Because I started a small business myself, and in the first couple of years, I paid my employees, I paid their health benefits, et cetera, and I made no money. And I wonder what the reaction is when you try to pitch workers cooperatives to people and say there may or may not be profit.
Good question, Don. Let me throw that to John Duda.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think one thing is that profits are often the icing on the cake, and the cake is a steady job with wages and work with dignity. So a lot of times it may take a long time to get to a point where you have profit, where you are really actually banking money into your worker account with the company that's above and beyond what you're getting from your wage or your salary. But as long as you're getting your wage or your salary and the business is stable and a good place to work and is an empowering workplace, people are often pretty happy with that. And actually, if you look at survival rates for worker cooperatives, and this is surprising because most people think these are wildly impractical things that are going to have all sorts of trouble and problems. And while there are certainly roadblocks and impediments to scale, what you find is actually that the survival rate for worker cooperatives has been about twice of normal businesses.
What are those numbers?
I believe that these are coming from a number of Canadian studies where there's a much more robust sector and more data to look at. But I think they were looking at something about, I want to say maybe it was they were twice as likely to celebrate their 10th birthday as businesses than normal businesses that have been started as public or private companies.
Don, thank you for the call. I appreciate your raising that point. Melissa, in Spain, you interviewed some people in upper-level management, and they say they're happy with their relatively modest salaries. But I wonder if large worker co-ops can attract skilled workers when the model doesn't allow for them to make as much money as they might elsewhere, because you don't have nearly the differential of high salaries and low salaries in a worker-owned co-op that we're used now to seeing in other businesses in the United States economy.
Well, what we saw in Mondragon was that people really liked working in this cooperative sector. And some of the management had worked in the private sector as well, but then came back to the cooperative network because they liked working in a more democratic and job secure situation. In the U.S., so when they say they're making a modest salary in Mondragon, the lowest to the highest paid workers varies. Maybe the CEO of a very big cooperative might make 5 or 7 times as much as the lowest paid worker. So in a worker cooperative, the decisions are made how people are going to get paid. It doesn't mean that absolutely everybody gets paid the same. In the U.S., as we know, in some companies, some CEOs are making 400 times as much as the lowest paid employee. And in my mind, you know, if you can spread some of that around, people are going to walk home with a better paycheck. But in the co-ops that we visited in the U.S., the scale seemed to vary between everybody being paid equally, like the Arizmendi bakeries in the Bay Area, to people maybe making as much as 5 to 1. So the highest paid person to the lowest paid person. And it was so interesting at the engineering firm in Madison, Wisconsin, I asked about, well, how do you decide what people get paid and what is the difference in pay? So the members of that co-op are in sales, they are engineers, they are machinists, at various different skills, but every year they have an open discussion about what a person's contribution to the company is and what they should be paid based on an hourly scale. And I said, well, here you are, two of you are founders, have been in the company for 25 years, and then many people are younger or newer or, you know, working in different parts of the business, you know, what is the difference in pay scale? And they said less than 2 to 1, which was pretty amazing to me.
That is the range, not individual pay scale, but the structure of the business is only a 2 to 1 difference in wages.
Yes.
I understand you, Melissa, that you are making a new film about the cooperative economy in Italy. Tell us about
that. Yes, it just got released by Bullfrog Films. It's called Weeconomics, Italy. It's a short piece looking at a city which has one of the most developed cooperative economies in the developed world. And it's available from Bullfrog Films. If you go to our website, shiftchange.org, you can see a preview of the film. And it's another example, hopefully the first in a new series, that looks at some more sustainable and equitable and democratic types of approaches to an economy. And part of what we try and do is think about, well, where can we go? We're having trouble with growing inequality in this country, and there are alternatives, and we should be looking at them and trying them out.
Chris is calling us from Frederick with a different point of view. Chris, welcome to the show.
Hi. I don't know if this is a different point of view, but I wanted to ask the question of what occurred with United Parcel Service, or UPS, several years ago. And I think they used to be an employee-owned company, and those employees decided to cash out and go public. And so that was a reverse trend. What would stop this movement, or what would stop that from happening with a really successful business and then all of a sudden the employees wanting to cash out and then and no longer being a cooperative or an employee-owned company?
Chris, thanks for the question. John Duda?
Yeah, so, I mean, obviously if you give people democratic control over their workplace, they can make that decision. What I think we've seen is that as people have started thinking about worker cooperatives as an inclusive economic development strategy, we've seen people start to grapple with that problem in really interesting ways. So, for instance, the organization I work with, the Democracy Collaborative, has been involved in an effort in Cleveland, Ohio, where we've helped catalyze a network of three worker cooperatives that employ about 120 people. And these have been funded through public investments, through philanthropic investments, the local community foundation. A lot of people have pitched in to put a lot of capital into creating opportunities for folks coming out of neighborhoods with like 40% unemployment and some really severe barriers to getting jobs. And so that investment, obviously, you don't want people to – you want to give people a job that they control, that they own, that they have democratic management over, but you want to make sure that that investment doesn't just get pocketed by people. And so what we've set up is a nonprofit structure that sits in the middle of all three of these cooperatives, and it holds a single golden share, essentially. And that golden share basically gives it veto power over dissolution of the cooperatives and not much other decision-making power. So it's a way, there are ways of thinking about hybrid models that allow you to put money into worker cooperatives, but give you the ability to, you know, make sure that exactly what the kind of thing that you're talking about, where a co-op just decides, hey, let's just sell the business, doesn't happen.
Chris, thanks for that call. We need to take another short break here. And Melissa Young, co-producer of the documentary Shift Change, needs to leave us. Thank you so much for being part of this discussion, Melissa.
Oh, I was really glad to participate.
Shift Change profiles some of this country's most successful worker-owned cooperatives, as well as a giant worker-owned network in Spain. If you'd like to learn more about Shift Change or see the film, go to the Midday page on WYPR.org for more information. John Duda is staying with us. After this short break, we'll talk about the ins and outs of founding and running a worker-owned business. Duda is co-founder of Red Emma's, a worker-owned coffee shop and bookstore in Baltimore. You can join the conversation. If you're an employee at a traditional business, would you even want to own a share in that business? Are there advantages to hierarchy in the business world? Join our conversation. Send us an email at midday@wypr.org or phone us 410-662-8780. I'm Sheila Cast. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Midday. I'm Sheila Cast. If you're just joining us, we're talking about worker-owned cooperatives. These are member-owned businesses, employee-owned businesses, where each person, no matter their position, has one vote. I'm speaking with John Duda, co-founder of Red Emma's, a coffee shop and bookstore in Baltimore City. Duda is also communications coordinator for the Democracy Collaborative, a nonprofit focused on community-based development. Do you think it takes a certain kind of person to work, to join a worker-owned enterprise? Join our conversation. Send us an email at midday@wypr.org or phone us at 410-662-8780. Meredith of Baltimore phoned us. Meredith, welcome to Midday.
Hi, Sheila. Thanks so much for having me.
Sure.
So I was calling today because I am a worker owner of a business here in Baltimore. I work at Baltimore Bicycle Works. We started our business about 7 years ago, and like I said, we're a worker-owned cooperative, and it, for me, has been a great experience. And I just wanted to call and, you know, share the experiences that I've, you know, had, and, you know, how it's different than working in a traditional space. But, you know, for us, it's been extremely successful and a differentiator for us in the marketplace.
Melissa, what is different about Meredith? What is different about it from working in a traditional space? What's the biggest difference that you feel?
Well, I would say that for me, the biggest difference is my ability to have influence over the business and have a say in the work that I'm doing and be able to, you know, have direction, you know, like input and direction of the business and work collaboratively with the, you know, with the other people that I'm working with. So, you know, nobody's making decisions all alone and we're all working together. We have meetings every week where we sit down and we discuss the major, you know, issues that are facing the business. And we make decisions together, and I think it helps us to make better, more informed decisions when we're getting input from various different aspects and people with different experiences and different experiences in the business. So for me, you know, all those things have had a major, you know, impact and are, I think, a really positive part about working here.
And were you part of the creation of Baltimore Bicycle Works?
Yes, I was. I'm one of the founding members. There were five of us. Three of us remain at the business today, and so I've been here from the beginning.
And you've been there since the beginning. How many worker owners are there now?
We fluctuate a little bit between, we're at eight people right now, but we are looking to hire, so we'll be back up to nine probably in the next few weeks.
And at the beginning, how did you all know that it was a cooperative that you wanted to establish as opposed to a small business?
Sure. Well, I think that, you know, we had been thinking critically about the economy and the structure of the business. Some of us, you know, we had worked in more traditional workspaces and had been dissatisfied with the, you know, owner-employee relationship and wanted to, you know, basically test the model and see if it was possible to form a business that would mean that nobody had to be somebody else's boss or manager and that we could work together on a more equitable level.
Meredith, I appreciate your calling us.
Of course. Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Sure. I want to ask you the same question, John Duda. 13 years ago, you helped start Red Emma's, the worker-owned bookstore and coffee shop around the corner from our studios. Well, a couple blocks and around the corner. How did you decide how that business would work?
You know, I won't lie. Red Emma's was coming out of a very, very activist environment and being founded by people who were deeply concerned about democracy and about equality. So we really started the project with the assumption that it was going to be a democratic workplace. We were, you know, from the get-go, that was...
How many of you were there at the get-go?
There was about eight people involved at the get-go and we're 20 worker owners today.
So take us into that mm-hmm. founding conversation.
Yep.
I mean, you knew you wanted a democratic workplace.
Yeah. But we didn't know how to do it. That was one of the really interesting things is that there was very little support at the time, 2003, 2004. There was very little infrastructure on a national level or a local level. So, you know, we just assumed we were just being idealistic and maybe impractical. And then what we found as we grew, as we solidified as a business, was that actually people all across the country were doing this kind of work. And we discovered and connected to all sorts of resources that really helped us understand what we were doing, helped us understand that we could grow in really interesting ways and helped us get more serious about the project.
What was the hardest? What was the early hurdles? What was the highest?
You know, I think access to capital was a really hard one. None of us were wealthy when we started the project. We had no money to invest in the project outside of, you know, what we could come up with from, you know, basically shaking out the couch cushions. So we, you know, we weren't able to open at the scale that I think would have been better for us to open way back then.
How did you crack the capital issue, the financing issue?
Part of that is just lots of new sources of funding that are kind of co-op friendly coming online. So we were very lucky to have the support of a local foundation, the Research Associates Foundation. It's a small progressive community-based foundation that made a investment in the new space. There was there's a national cooperative of cooperatives that funds cooperatives. That's a lot of cooperatives in one sentence, but that's the shared capital cooperative They also made a loan to us, as well as a funder called The Working World, which is a nonprofit lender with a really interesting model of supporting worker-owned businesses. And we've seen how much that's meant to us as a cooperative, and we've decided to really try and pay that forward and help set up some of that infrastructure locally. So together with Meredith and Baltimore Bicycle Works and a number of other partners and allies, we're working on, together with The Working World, to set up a local revolving fund that would provide a kind of common pool of capital for people who are interested in starting worker cooperatives or converting their businesses to worker cooperatives.
Do you think Baltimore, with everything that makes up Baltimore right now, mm-hmm. at this particular moment in economic history, is Baltimore an especially fertile place for worker cooperatives? Worker cooperatives, yeah.
I think so. I think we see a lot of concern around inequality. We see a lot of concern around racial equity in the economy. And some of the most exciting movement in the worker cooperative space has precisely been around trying to figure out how do you get the people who have been most excluded from the economy a real stake in it. And worker cooperatives can be a really powerful way to do that. So I would love to see, as people think about how to reinvest in Baltimore, as people think about how we build, how we decide on the economic development priorities for Baltimore, I would love to see worker cooperatives fit into that strategy. And that's something we've seen in other cities. So New York City, for instance, made a very interesting commitment of $1.2 million into worker cooperatives a number of years ago. They basically said, we're going to finance the infrastructure for people who want to develop worker cooperatives in historically marginalized communities, communities that are facing high unemployment, are facing disinvestment. And as a city, we're going to publicly commit money to make worker-owned businesses possible in those neighborhoods. And in a year, they had doubled the number of worker cooperatives in the city. They're on track to triple it. And they've seen the success of this, so they've increased the funding to $2.1 million. And there's even talk of taking it to the state level in New York. That's also happening in Madison. It's happening in other cities across the country. So I think as people deal with challenges around deindustrialization, around inequality, they try and come up with a way to spend the billions of dollars that are spent on economic development assistance, trying to attract or retain businesses maybe in a smarter way and in a way that roots a little more money in the community. I think worker cooperatives can be really powerful there.
But there are so many claims on whatever money Baltimore or Maryland could invest in business development in Baltimore. What's the killer argument you would make for a fund for worker cooperatives being where the state, for example, should put some money?
I think if I had to make a single argument around this, I would say that this is a way to directly give the people we're trying to help with all of our policies a stake in the economy. It's not a trickle-down policy. It's not a cut taxes for this developer so they can make this project happen so it causes some jobs to be created, and hopefully those are good jobs and hopefully those are local jobs. It's a way of directly empowering the people who really need the most help when we're talking about where public resources should go. And at this point, I think it's I'm not a worker cooperative purist, but I do think it should be part of our menu of strategies, along with other forms of inclusive community wealth building.
We haven't talked at all about the network of co-ops in Cleveland, which the Democracy Collaborative helped start. Tell us briefly about them.
Yeah, so that was a project that got started in 2006, 2007. It's called the Evergreen Cooperatives. You can see some great footage of it in the film that Melissa and Mark made, Shift Change. And it's a project that was designed to tackle basically structural unemployment in a city where the departure of industry had been really devastating, but where you had a number of really successful, high-profile nonprofit institutions, hospitals and universities, world-class hospitals like Cleveland Clinic. And what they found is that these giant nonprofit institutions were right next to these neighborhoods that were devastated, primarily communities of color, where people really had very little opportunities. And the effort was made to take the purchasing power of those institutions, the laundry that they do on a daily basis, the food that they purchase for their cafeterias, the power that they use to run their facilities, and think about how to take that money that they were already spending and use it to catalyze the formation of worker cooperatives. So it gave them basically a guaranteed market. It gave them a little bit of a way to get their businesses off the ground, knowing that there would be some demand for what they had to offer. And that facilitated a lot of capital investment. The Cleveland Foundation, which is the nation's oldest community foundation, was a major advocate and supporter of the project. And today, these are three businesses that are doing really well, that are paying a living wage to their employees, giving them a say in the way their workplaces are run, and really demonstrating that this is a feasible strategy.
Well, there certainly has been some glowing press around the Cleveland cooperatives, but there's also been reports that that they have financial troubles. When the Democracy Collaborative originally predicted that after 7 years, workers would each have $65,000 in equity. After 7 years, they are nowhere near that. Is that just growing pains, or
part of it is growing pains? I mean, this project got off the ground, like I said, in 2007, right? Just about everybody had economic troubles around that time. Certainly, a lot of our projections were a little optimistic. You know, anybody who started a business can attest to, you run into things that you had no idea you would expect. You know, if your business plan is actually, you know, describing the reality you're seeing 7 years out from your startup, you're probably, you know, might be a cause for worry.
We have just a minute left, mm-hmm. and I want to pull this mm-hmm. together, because when I hear you talk about the value that could be from government support, mm-hmm. Like a fund, or the guaranteed markets that big institutions could give you, I can hear some of our listeners saying, it just proves that these worker cooperatives are not really able to compete in a capitalist economy. They need some extra support.
I mean, I think it's a myth that we have a totally capitalist economy. We have so much support at every level for business coming from government, whether that's the tax breaks that we give, as deductions for mortgage payments, whether that's the business assistance we give at a city level. What I think we're asking for is a reorientation of some of that commitments towards forms that are really democratic and really help people who need the most help.
Interesting conversation. I really appreciate your being here for it. John Duda, he is co-founder of Red Emma's, a worker-owned coffee shop and bookstore here in Baltimore. And Duda is also communications coordinator for the Democracy Collaborative, a policy research institute in Tacoma Park that supports worker-owned enterprises. Earlier, we spoke with Melissa Young, co-producer of the documentary about worker co-ops called Shift Change. More information about that at the Midday page at WIPR.org. I also want to thank The Veranda for providing lunch for Midday's guests. The Veranda serves farmers markets in and around Baltimore. It features homemade Indian street food with vegetarian and vegan options. The Veranda is located on the Avenue in Hamden. Menu and catering information at TheVerandaBaltimore.net. And thank you for listening. Tune in tomorrow to learn what amnesia patients can teach us about memory. I'm Sheila Cast. Have a great afternoon.